So, what we're going to do is, like each week, I'm going to back up a wee bit, get a running start over the verses that we have looked at together. I'm going to read them slowly so that each of us can form mental pictures in our mind of what is happening and what we're learning. The Eshet Chayil, a woman of valor. A woman of valor who can find. She is far more precious than jewels or pearls, remember? The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She's like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it, and with the fruit of her hands, he plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength, and she makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable, and her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her palms to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all of her household are clothed in scarlet. Hopefully you all have plenty of images coming into your mind and your heart. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Let's go back to verse 13 once again. She makes bed coverings for herself. Anybody recall the Hebrew word for those bed coverings? Starts with an M. Marvadim. Thank you. Marvadim. And her clothing is fine linen and purple. The root word of that word, Marvadim, for bed coverings is the word Ravid, which is R-A-V-I-D. There's a connection that we're going to see. We're going to turn to Ezekiel 16, and I wrote the passages on the board in case you're more visual than audio, than able to hear. And remember, Ezekiel 16, 8 through 14. So tonight, I love, because what we're going to do is we're taking a real macro view. Macro. Sometimes we do micro. Last week we looked at Tola Worm. That's a micro view of something really, really profound. Tonight is just as much or more, but it's macro. And we're looking at the big story, the divine romance of God husbanding us. And what I want us to do, ladies, some of you may not be familiar with these passages. They're very, very explicit. Some of you might be surprised by some of the verbiage and the imagery in these passages. So we're going to begin in Ezekiel 16. And I want you to let the words soak in. I'm going to back up to verse 6. This is the Lord speaking to his bride, Israel. He says, when I passed by you and saw you squirming in your blood, I said to you while you were in your blood, live. Yes, I said to you while you were in your blood, live. I made you numerous, like plants of the field. Then you grew up, became tall, and reached the age for fine ornaments. Your breasts were formed, and your hair had grown. Yet you were naked and bare. Then I passed by you and saw you, and behold, you were at the time for love. So I spread my skirt over you. I covered your nakedness. I also swore to you and sent and entered into a covenant with you so that you became mine, declares the Lord God. Then I bathed you with water, washed your blood from you, and anointed you with oil. I also clothed you with embroidered cloth and put sandals of porpoise skin on your feet. The porpoise skin, the kind of leather that he places on her feet, are marvit. That is the same, or ravid, that is the root word from marvadim, the bed coverings. Okay? And I wrapped you with fine linen and covered you with silk. I adorned you with ornaments, and I put bracelets on your hands and a necklace around your neck. I also put a ring in your nostril, earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. Thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your dress was fine linen, silk, and embroidered cloth. You ate fine flour, honey, and oil, so you were exceedingly beautiful and advanced in royalty. Then your fame went forth among the nations on account of your beauty, for it was perfect. Because my splendor, which I bestowed on you, declares the Lord. And then the next verse is pretty tragic. But you trusted in your beauty, and you played the harlot because of your fame. And you poured out your harlotries on every passerby who might be willing. How many of you have never read that passage before? It's pretty explicit, isn't it? That's his husband's heart toward his bride. That's the macro story. Okay? Let's go on. Isaiah 54, 1 through 8. Shout for joy, O barren one, you who have borne no child. Break forth into joyful shouting. Cry aloud, you who have not travailed. For the sons of the desolate will be more numerous than the sons of the married woman, says the Lord. Those of you who say, what fruit can I produce in this world? I don't even have children of my own. This is God's heart. For the sons of the desolate one will be more numerous than the sons of the married woman, says the Lord. Enlarge the place of your tent. Stretch out the curtains of your dwellings, spare not. Lengthen your cords, strengthen your pegs, for you will spread abroad to the right and to the left, and your descendants will possess nations and will resettle the desolate cities. Fear not, you will not be put to shame. And do not feel humiliated, for you will not be disgraced. But you will not forget the shame of your youth and the reproach of your widowhood. You will remember no more. For your husband is your maker, whose name is the Lord of hosts. And your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel, who is called the God of all the earth. For the Lord has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, even like a wife of one's youth when she's rejected, says your God. For a brief moment I forsook you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In an outburst of anger, I hid my face for a moment. But that's overshadowed by what? But with everlasting loving kindness, I will have compassion on you, says your Lord and your Redeemer. Man. I was reading these verses this morning when my soup burned on the stove because I was just immersed in, I started smelling something and, yeah, I ruined my soup. Isaiah 62, 1 through 5. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not keep quiet, until her righteousness goes forth like brightness, and her salvation like the torch that is burning. The nations will see your righteousness, and all the kings your glory, and you will be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord will designate. You will also be a crown of beauty in the land of the Lord, a royal diadem in the hand of your God. It will no longer be said to you, forsaken. Nor to your land will it be called desolate. You will be called, you ready? My delight is in her. And your land married, for the Lord delights in you, and to him your land will be married. For as a young man marries a virgin, so your sons will marry you, and as your bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God rejoices over you. Now there are layers and layers and layers of things that we could learn about and study about in all of these passages that I've shared, but I want to show you a glimpse at the husband heart of God. That is his heart. And he's not shy about it. So now we're ready to read verse 14 in our text of Proverbs 31. Keeping all of this in mind as a backdrop, her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. So out of the entire text in Proverbs 31, our woman of valor that we've been looking at, basically, her husband isn't mentioned or talked about. He's not front and center. He's behind the scenes, isn't he? But he's drenching the entire text in his presence. Okay? He's drenching all of everything that's happening in his presence. And we are aware of that. But this is where we see where he is exactly. He sits where? With the elders of the land. And he is known where? In the gates. In the gates. I was able to gain more appreciation for this description on the recent trip we took to Israel. How many of you went to Megiddo? Remember going to Megiddo? It was hard to walk there, wasn't it? But we had a great guide, and Benny was explaining as we approached these ancient ruins of this ancient city. The gates were still pretty well intact. It was amazing. And I learned so many things I had never known before, but as I was standing there, I could hear his voice, and all I could think about was how he sits in the gates with the elders of the land. And it all started to make so much sense, because here's the deal. We learned that in the ancient cities, like the one mentioned in our text, there isn't just one gate, but there is an outer wall with a gate, and then there's space, and then there's an inner wall with a gate. There are guards at the outer gate, but the elders most carefully guard the inner gate, because past that gate is the inner sanctum, where the true residents of the true city dwell. That's where the wives of the leaders in the gates are living. That's where they live, right? And so at the gates, folks are engaging in coming and going and commerce. So the space between the inner and the outer walls is where people come out from the city and come in from the outside, and they mix. There's buying, there's selling, there's business. All kinds of daily life is engaged there. And so what the guards at the outer gate are doing is they're watching. And they're making sure that nobody who shouldn't get through those inner gates is going to get through those inner gates, because there's another set of guards there. They watch for people who are beggars, because beggars will come to the gates, poor people, and they'll, you know, be trying to get their food for the day. And I learned that what the elders at the gates will do is they will call attention to a beggar, but not for the purpose of making the beggar feel small, but for the purpose of rebuking the townspeople for allowing someone to come to that place. How could you, as townspeople, allow this man to be so desperate? Why aren't you taking better care of your own? That was one of their responsibilities. Amazing. I didn't know that. So they would rebuke the people for not taking better care of the poor, all right? These judges and guardians would mete out justice to address each potential threat to those within the city. Every person had to be judged as safe for the good of the town, all right? So what they would do is, if somebody who wasn't safe would try to get past the gates, they would actually have a bit of a trial there. And if someone needed to be executed, they would literally be executed there at the gates. Anything that needed to be decided was decided there at the gates. The coming in, the going out was guarded by these elders, these men, at the gates. So you understand, the people inside the city, the wife of the elder lives not only within the outer gate, but within the inner gate. She's safe. Nothing's going to get to her unless it gets past the elders of the gates. And he doesn't just sit. Her husband, our woman of valor, who lives inside that inner sanctum, she isn't only married to one of the elders, but he is the elder of the elders. You see what I mean? He is the one who is the authority over the authorities. That's where we live. We live in a place where our God is guarding the gate. When we were there, I met an artist, thanks to Kathleen, and he's messianic. He believes in Messiah, and so his artwork is that much more special. But I picked this up, and it says, "On your walls, O Jerusalem, I have appointed watchmen." I love this. To me, this denotes masculinity. This man is at the wall. He's engaged in prayer, but he's got his Uzi strapped on. And he's protecting the ones he loves, right? We have a husbandman who's guarding the gate of our life. Nothing is going to get to us unless he permits it. It's a safe place to dwell. And while the woman of valor knows that he's where he's supposed to be, he's also making sure that all the goods and trading that needs to happen to deliver to her all the resources she needs to build her life get to her. You get it? So she's in there getting what she needs to do life, and she's guarded from anything that could prevent her from being able to do that. If we could get that, if we could get that and know that, Kim?
Is there any correlation in this with the gates of the New Jerusalem?
I don't know.
I don't know. Because there would be gates and there,
the north, south, east, and west, and all of that. I don't know. I have to think about that. Good question. The other thing I learned while we were in Megiddo is that typically the water source isn't inside the city, it's outside the city. Okay? So in this town, what they would do is they oversaw the project to create, in Megiddo, they had an underground water source and tunnels. They don't even know how they accomplished it. And they would oversee the people going through these tunnels and safely getting to the water source outside the city. And I'm thinking, such thorough protection for those who dwelled within those city walls. And the verse that came to me immediately was when God says, "Come, all of you who are thirsty, come and drink." And he has this eternal water source that it's his job to provide to us as we live safely within the city walls while he guards the gate. He's sitting at the gates of our life. He's sitting there, and he's sitting at the gates of the world. So no matter how out of control and crazy things feel, the husband is known in the gates. He's known. He's respected by the authorities as he sits among the elders of the land. I just think it's amazing. So many things happening there. You know, he never slumbers or sleeps. We don't have to worry about an enemy slipping past him when he's not paying attention. Right? He's always sovereign. There's a passage in Psalm 104, the first 5 verses. And I just went to this as I was thinking about his sovereignty the other day. It says, "O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a cloak." That's what he dresses himself in. "Stretching out heaven like a tent curtain." There's our tent. "He lays beams of his upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He walks upon the wings of the wind. He makes the winds his messengers, flaming fire his ministers. He establishes the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever." You know, we forget, and we can start to think that coronavirus is more powerful or more of a threat to us than he's able to, you know what I mean? We start to feel very vulnerable and we forget the truth. That's why I said tonight, it's a macro picture, it's a reminder. So the woman who is traditionally assigned to represent this portion of our woman of valor, or Ishakael, is David's wife, Michal. Now, he had several. But do you remember who Michal's father was? Right. So here she is, sandwiched between her father's dangerous intent for David and her husband, who she dearly loved. She had to make some tough choices. It's supposed that the whole reason that Michal was set up to marry David and permitted was for a very political reason, and Saul had his political purposes for making sure that he set his daughter up with David, thinking that it was going to somehow protect his power. At one point, remember the story where she had to protect her own husband from her father's wicked schemes, and she put a pretend man made with blankets and things under the, and then she put goat's hair in the bed to make it look like David was there, but David wasn't there. David ran, and because she had the courage and the devotion to her husband to do that, David was none other than with Samuel the prophet, receiving from him all the wisdom that he was going to need in the days to come. So what she did provided for David on so many levels. He was actually outgaining the necessary tools to reign as king of Israel while her father was trying to do him in. Crazy story. An amazing woman. It becomes apparent that true marriage, whether literal or metaphorical, is always symbiotic. What does symbiotic mean? It means that it's mutually life-giving and beneficial. Because here we have our text where it says her husband is known in the gates as he sits among the elders of the land. He's protecting. He's providing water. He's providing everything he needs. He's keeping her safe. He's making sure she has her resources. But then we have this woman assigned to think about, who is also giving back, protecting, providing, watching his back. It's symbiotic. The wife trusts the husband to be her guardian and provide the necessary resources for the life they share, while he trusts her to have his back at all times. Respecting him to do what he does and making the most of every resource that he's provided. Do you see? You see how that works? When male and female submit to one another, each makes it possible for the other to fulfill their role and purpose. Okay? I'm going to say that again. And if you're single, this does not exclude you. Because as we've established, you are betrothed to the God of the universe. Level playing field there for all of us. And the betrothal period was legal. You're legally married. You're in covenant. When male and female submit to one another, each makes it possible for the other to fulfill their role and purpose. One of the passages I love to share with new couples, we actually sat with a new couple today, and we were with David and Courtney, and we're talking about some of this cool stuff. It's in Ephesians 5. Let's go to Ephesians 5. And I know that this is familiar to a lot of us, but let's look at it through new eyes. Keeping this macro picture in mind, talking about marriage, how husbands should love their wives, okay? Nourishing it, protecting it, guarding the gates. Not all human men are very good at that. That's the ideal. And it says, this mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. So in other words, yeah, husbands and wives, this is how ideally it should look. But what I'm really talking about here is Messiah and his bride. That includes all of us. So verse 33 says, nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself. And the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. There's a symbiotic relationship that's represented by these words, love and respect. For women, it doesn't necessarily come supernatural or super easy and natural for all of us to always feel and share respect with the man we live with. Okay? And it doesn't typically necessarily come really natural for most men to cherish and express love to the wife he's married to. All right? So as we were talking to David and Courtney this morning, God's ultimate plan for marriage, he took Adam and Eve, which were one, he separated them, and he turned them to each other, and he said, now, make your way back to each other. And the process of a man and a woman choosing each other and making their way back is full of all kinds of speed bumps. And God says, the thing you have to overcome to make your way to this man on earth and to your husband in heaven, the thing you have to overcome is you. You overcome you, step by step by step. Whether you're married physically or not, this is our coming back. Remember when we started, we talked about how in Eden there was oneness between God and people and between man and wife. It was broken, and we're making our way back. We have to overcome ourselves. And I looked at Dave and Courtney this morning. Grant and I are pretty open, and we share the stuff that we've kind of battled, and we laugh together. And I said, there is nothing more humbling. You will never feel it. Because they're like, well, our egos have been... I go, you have no clue what your ego looks like until you're married. But you will. God says, husbands, love your wives. Wives, show respect to that man. And so we start to feel uncherished, unloved, and he starts to feel disrespected, and the spiral, instead of going up, begins to go down. And neither one wants to humble themselves to change the direction. But somebody has to humble themselves and change the direction. And when one person humbles themselves and says, you know what? I'm going to treat you as if you were the man I want you to be. And you start to exercise respect. And grab onto any drop of love that he throws your way, and you cherish it, and you acknowledge it, that direction can start to change. And then it picks up momentum. But it takes humility. Without humility, it can never happen. Maybe you're single, and it's hard to feel cherished by the one who made you. Maybe you just don't feel cherished. If you will stop and say, I am going to surrender, lean in, and respect what you have told me is true, guess what? You start to experience little twinges and drops of feeling cherished. It cycles together. Okay? Another glimpse at the important dynamic of elders at the gate. Tell me, which story in the Bible comes to mind? Who went to the elders of the gate to arrange a very important marriage? Boaz. He goes up to the gate and he sits there in order to arrange his marriage to Ruth. And he establishes his rightful place as her kinsman redeemer, and we know the rest of the story. That was the line of our Messiah. I mean, what an amazing story that is. Wow. I'm going to do something I don't like to do necessarily, but I wrote this and I can't improve on it. I'm going to read it to tie up this section of our study. Let's take a moment to step back and take a look at the entire text of Ishakiel, recognizing a few interesting things in particular, because I consider this first lady's the climax of our text, because we're seeing where her husband is. And everything that happens leading up and coming back away from is because he's doing what he's doing, all right? And he is where he is. This woman of valor, who represents the wife of Adonai, is not busy talking. She isn't spending most of her time at women's conferences and continually attending Bible studies. She doesn't appear especially religious. She's faithfully tending to her own household and responsibilities at hand, quietly and faithfully. She's extremely effective in everything she applies her heart and extends her hands to do. She's focused, committed, efficient, beautiful, loyal, stable, and mostly silent. Why do I emphasize silence? Because it's so typical to talk about religious things and to engage in religious activities instead of being the bride we are intended to be. And we can do that with peace and confidence. Why? Because our divine husband is always at his post, guarding the gate of our life, dispensing sound judgment, and preventing danger from entering our house. He is ever present, though he typically operates in the background while we maximize the resources and opportunities in our immediate world. His perfect presence is the underpinning of the entire description of our woman of valor. You get that? She has no desire to compete with her husband because she recognizes and appreciates how imperative his role is for her to fulfill her own potential. Comments? Make sense? He sits with the elders at the gates. He's there. So our next verse takes us back to linen for a moment. She, while he's doing what he does, she's still doing what she does safely within the gates of the city. She makes linen garments and sells them, and she delivers sashes to the merchant. Now, don't for a moment think that I'm talking about her living some small, confined life in a very small area, and she never goes anywhere. This is very spiritual language. This is very spiritual language, okay? She has a big world. She has a big, big world because it's not dictated by fear. It's not limited. So she makes linen garments and sells them, and she delivers sashes to the merchant. Okay, so we discussed linen a little bit and how special it is. One of the things I didn't talk about last week, but if you grabbed one of the handouts, you realize how tedious it is, the process of refining linen and taking flax, which is very, very raw and unusable, and turning it into linen. But here's a cool thing. One of those neat little treasures is that the word here in this verse for linen isn't the same as most of the words for linen that we see. It's not the same as the linen that we talked about last week. The word for this linen is the word sadin, S-A-D-I-N. Now, what's so important about this? This material is mentioned in another story. This is very same word, but it's recorded much later than the words of our Proverbs text. We find this word used in the book of Mark, chapter 15, when Joseph of Arimathea brought a linen cloth and he took the master down and he wrapped him in that linen, that sadin cloth, and he laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a stone against the entrance. That's the linen that she makes. Now, what is significant about this? Well, maybe you can have other insights to add, but one of the things that I find significant about this is that her loving kindness, caring for others, doesn't stop just with living, but it extends to those who are in no position to repay her. You know, we're told that one of the most remarkable acts of kindness we can do is to accompany the dead. What does that mean? It means that we show respect and we make sure that the dead are carefully cared for and buried appropriately, and that their life is honored in the way they depart from this physical world. She's doing that. They can't pay her back. So I started to ask myself, how many of the things I do aren't really giving, but they're sort of like selling, because you're sort of expecting, even on a subconscious level, that it's an investment and maybe some payback. Not her. Because she's providing linen for those who can't pay her back. See what I mean? I mean, her loving kindness goes beyond. And of course, the connection to Messiah and his burial clothes, layers and layers. Okay. Very unselfish behavior it represents. And then the second phrase here, it says she delivers sashes to the merchant. So the word for sash, another cool word, is chagor, C-H-A-G-O-R. You know where we find this word? So fascinating, you guys. It's the same word describing the covering of fig leaves in the garden. All right? So now let's follow this. What was the purpose of the fig leaves? Fig leaves provided covering for nakedness and shame. So our woman of valor not only makes linen bed coverings for her own self and for her beds and for her family, but she provides for those who can't repay her, those who are leaving this world. And she gives sashes, or chagor, fig leaves, to others. And we'll get to the word merchant in a moment. But she is all about covering shame, covering nakedness. The word for merchant is very interesting too. It means Canaanite. So she's not only providing these coverings for her people, her peeps, the ones that she feels safe and comfortable with, but she's covering the shame and the nakedness of pagans and outsiders, people very unlike her. Do we do that? I mean, do we do that? She really is a light in the darkness. It's very easy to slip into a sense of separation from others and to kind of get an us in them. Not so much as I used to, but it's still residual. I grew up in a tradition where people were always categorized. You were either saved or you weren't saved. And I remember being in prayer meetings and people would say, you know, would you please pray for my Aunt Sally? She's really, really sick and miserable right now. And the person in charge would say, is she saved? Well, she's sick. But in our mindset then, if you're saved, you're treated one way. And if you're unsaved, you're treated another way. In God's heart, we're all his children. All right? And the woman of valor knows that. And she provides covering for shame and nakedness for people, whether they're her dearest friends or whether they're Canaanites and have nothing in common for her, because she sees that every person is valuable. That's what I see in this passage. That's my goal. I'm not there. I'm probably never, but I'm working toward that goal. How do we cover people's shame? I think one of the main reasons we can do it is with our speech. Or when we hear someone else exposing another person, we can deliver sashes and provide fig leaves. Okay? With just words, we can create a verbal covering for other people's shame. We can. But do we? Do I? Even if they kind of seem to deserve the undressing. I mean, let's think how we talk about politicians. And I mean, do we cover people's shame? Or do we undress them? This goes beyond just the spouses we live with. I think the idea of covering shame is tragically disregarded in our culture. It really is. And spouses, you know, it's not uncommon for men, when they're out with their buds, to kind of allow their wives, the woman, the little woman, to be shamed because they don't want to appear like they're getting too domesticated to their buddies, okay? And then as women, they can start talking about their husbands are just stupid. You know, they're just dumb. They slight them for being uncaring and they don't pay attention to details. You know what I think? As I really, really have considered this, I think this tendency to go on the attack is a real tactic to avoid personal responsibility to fix things. Mm-hmm. I really do. And all it does is add another layer of distance between spouses, between people. We start to tell ourselves that lie that we'd be better off living on our own anyway. You know? We fuel that lie. Shaming and blaming reverses the process of God's intention for marriage, especially. It really does. What about people who are ridiculing the God that is our husband? Do we stand up for him in public? Do we allow him to be shamed in public? Do we provide fig leaves and sashes for our husband? It's a high standard. It is otherworldly. It is. It's a supernatural standard. We talked about it. This doesn't exist on a perfect level, but this is the ideal. This is our goal. This is where we need to return to. This is where we're making our way back to. And it's what makes life an awesome adventure, as we learn what the next step is, how to refine our souls, what do we work on now. And for every person in this room, the thing that we need to work on is not the same as the person sitting next to us. We're all at a different place. We all have a different assignment for the next step to make our soul bigger, better, purer. All right? So don't compare. There's a quote by Abraham Heschel. And I'm going to read it slowly. I can send you a copy if you want. But it says, oneness is the norm, the standard, and the goal. So that's our goal, oneness, all right? it's not the goal in our culture, but it's his standard and goal. If in the afterglow of a religious insight, we can see a way to gather up scattered lives, to unite what lies in strife, all right, then we know it is a guidepost on his way. But if a thought generates pride, separation from other people's suffering, and unawareness of the dangers of evil, we know it is a deviation from his way. So if a thought, a word, or an action is accommodating oneness and healing, we know it's his way. If it's bringing pride and separation from other people's suffering, and it's scattering the pieces even further, it's a deviation from his way. Pretty easy way to decide what's holy and what's not. Because the woman of valor, what does she do? She uses discernment and she separates what is holy from what is profane. She separates. She makes choices. She divides what needs to be divided. Okay? How we doing? All right? Are you feeling the husband heart of God more clearly? And he covers our shame. Remember the verses we read in Isaiah? He covers our shame. So now we come to Proverbs 31:25. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. Now, I've talked a lot about choosing the clothes we put on, that putting on strength and dignity. We talked a little bit last week about you have to undress from what you don't want to be wearing, but it's not enough to take it off. You have to put something new on. Spiritually speaking, that's super important. We were talking with friends last night about a situation we know close in my world, where someone took off years and years and years of shame and addiction and a very demonic stronghold of fear. And they had temporary, amazing relief. And I said to this person that I love so much, you're not done. You have to fill that space. And you have to fill it carefully and wisely. And you have to be real intentional about it. Because remember the warning. that if the strong man, and we're the strong man of our house, and if the enemy binds us, he has a heyday. But when God sets us free, we take over and take authority of this house, and we say, whoa, these rooms are not going to be filled with darkness anymore. They're going to be filled with light. And remember our virgins with oil? Who can fill the lamp for our own life? We do. He provides it, but we go to him and we fill it, or we don't. It's all connected. Do you see how these verses weave together and all these? So strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. Why can she laugh? Because she knows that the future holds everything. Everything coming together, and there's beauty, and everything is synchronized, everything's reconnected. You know, I see these words, dignity and strength are her clothing, and she laughs at the days to come. I see it on signs and pillows and wall hangings, and kind of gets on my nerves because I feel like it's going to become a trite, familiar saying that we just don't really understand and think about how profound the impact of the words are. That happens. You know, it's that lullaby effect that you hear something over and over and over and it stops meaning anything. Like the lullaby, rock-a-bye baby on a treetop when the wind blows. Why does anyone say that to their baby? But we've said it all our lives, and so we forget what we're singing, and we don't even think about the words anymore. And as Rabbi Foreman says, the lullaby effect kicks in, and we just mouth words without really stopping to say, hey, what does that really mean? So we need to stop at verse 25 and say, hey, what does this really mean? Well, I have found that sometimes in order to realize what something is, it's very helpful to understand what it isn't. All right? God does this in his word. He gives us contrasts and comparisons. So I was sitting at my desk not so long ago, and I took this text describing the woman of valor, and I rewrote it to describe who she's not. I'm going to read it to you. Are you ready? And I go from the start to the finish of the text. So here we go. An unfaithful wife is easy to find. She is surprisingly common these days. The heart of her husband has hardened long ago after numerous betrayals. She rarely considers him as important and does him harm with her words and deeds. She seeks out glitter and glam and avoids effort when possible. She likes to drive a trendy car and she spends a great deal to chase her fantasies. She loves to sleep in until everyone has left the house. She left cereal in the cupboard, though there might not be fresh milk. She shops at the last minute and purchases convenient items. Fresh market items take too much time to prepare. She dresses herself with the latest trendy fashions and works out at the gym for several hours a day. She tends to overspend and hopes the bank balance will eventually work out enough to prevent her husband from noticing. She loves to meet her friends in the evenings after work. She disdains the people who are needy, and she wishes they would just stay behind closed doors where they belong. She dreads the boring winter months when her tan fades and she has to do extra laundry. She hires a decorator to outdo her friend's redo, and she struggles to keep her wardrobe current. Her husband's buddies feel sorry for him because they realize that she sucks the life out of him. She re-gifts the junky stuff her family gives her for holidays, and she saves her money for top-of-the-line items that she buys online. She's whiny and uptight and never content. She always expresses dread of what is certainly going to be her next trial. She talks loudly and gossips about people she knows, and her tongue is quick to criticize. She's glad when the kids are off to school or wherever. She has time to herself, finally. Her children enjoy spending time at their friends' homes, especially at mealtime when the family sits and eats together over there. Many women have done better than you, and you resent that you are not appreciated. Charm is your go-to, and your wrinkles are outpacing your Botox treatments. And the idea of fearing God is ridiculous. And there isn't much to show for all the time and money she spends. And her reputation affirms that very thing.
Very good.
So when I see a woman with quiet dignity and joy, I take special notice. I see a lot of them around me. I think we see them here in our community a lot, and we're working on it. Especially when I see a woman who can weather the storms of life without reacting rashly and angrily and selfishly. She isn't out trying to find support groups for everything, right? Is it wrong to go to support groups? Is it wrong to hang out with your friends? It depends. You know, sometimes we're just looking for affirmation for our misery. We're not really looking for answers. There's a time and a place. But you know what I have found, ladies? I have found that the woman of valor is comfortable with solitude a lot because she senses the nearness of her bridegroom. And she's occupied with what's at hand. She doesn't have a lot of time to be out seeking friendship support. And you know what else I have found out? I've learned that spiritual growth is in many ways a solitary pursuit. All right? So you say, well, I'm an extrovert and I need friends around me all the time. Well, it's going to stunt your growth. You've got to learn to take the high road, and sometimes it's a solitary road, right? And sometimes it can feel a little lonely, and that's why he says, I'll send my comforter. And like we were talking the other night when we had friends over, I said, years ago when I started this tour journey, it felt weird. And I thought, well, where's my group? Where's my mob? I need an identity. And a very wise man said, Robin, how many people enter the Holy of Holies to meet with God? One. So as you go further in and you become closest to his presence, the crowd thins out. Now, you're going to have dear friends, but they're not going to be the ones that you spend most of your solitary time with. You've got to learn to be comfortable with the intimacy of your bridegroom. Did you know the Jews refer to the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle as God's bridal chamber? Because that's where he meets one-on-one with his bride, his people. It's very sexy talk. But as I read from Ezekiel and Isaiah, he's not shy about using the metaphor of intimacy to describe his relationship with his people. We need to think on those levels, okay? So in keeping with the contrast and compare tactic, I chose a woman this week who is the antithesis of dignity and strength. All right? And her name is Jezebel. And we find her described in 2 Kings. Now, I don't know how many of you have read about Jezebel lately, but I reviewed her life a little bit over the last week. And remember, she was married to King Ahab. And remember, King Ahab was pretty wealthy and he had a lot of vineyards. But do you remember there was one guy named Naboth who had a vineyard that King Ahab wanted and Naboth said no. And Ahab threw a temper tantrum, a literal temper tantrum. What a scene. The king turns his face to the wall and pouts. And she goes in and she says, don't you worry, I'm going to get that vineyard for you. And she starts to work on it. So she arranges for that good man to be stoned to death in order for her pathetic husband to take possession of that piece of land. Now let's compare her to the woman of valor, what she does when she sees the potential of a field. And her husband comes alongside and she purchases this field and then he helps her plant. And the fruit of that vineyard feeds many forever. And so here's Jezebel. And they want this vineyard for themselves. They want to take. And so the time comes for Jezebel to kind of reap what she has sown in wickedness. And what she does is she reverts to her most familiar tactic. And she's going to seduce. And she's going to flirt. And it kind of cracks me up because what she does is she paints her face and adorns her head and she looks out the window and I picture her like batting her eyelashes thinking, I've got this. And some of the men standing nearby shove her out the window. And I wrote in parentheses, so much for her eye makeup and hairdo. And she's eaten by the dogs. And all they find, remember, is like her palms and the bottoms of her feet. And I was thinking when we started this study how we talked about how there are women who have left footprints in the world for us to follow and come closer to knowing him well. But not this one. She literally didn't leave footprints, but the pads of her feet are the only thing left in the courtyard. Think of it. It's so gross. What a contrast between the woman of valor and Jezebel. I mean, there's more we could talk about, but what a contrast. You know, here's the woman of valor dressed in strength and dignity, and her husband can trust her to never do harm, and she produces all this beautiful fruit. And then Jezebel, she uses deception to purchase a field for her wicked husband in order to indulge his greed, and she assumes that she can avoid punishment by seduction and manipulation because taking has become her M.O. And she assumed that she could defy God himself, but in the end, there wasn't even enough remaining of her to bury. What a picture. I know, right? So when I look at these two feminine figures, Jezebel and the woman of valor, I see them standing at complete extreme opposites of a spectrum. And I'll call it the spectrum of femininity for our conversation. And I drew a spectrum over on the whiteboard. And on the left, you see the word fool. And on the right, at the opposite end of the spectrum, on the right side, intentionally, I wrote the word valor. Valor gives, a fool takes. Valor is always motivated by love. And a fool is motivated by fear, and in some cases, they appear to be very, very brave. But they're motivated by the fear of not having enough. So they always have to keep taking. Jezebel wasn't motivated by love. She was a fearful, very self-indulgent soul. So I started thinking about the difference between male and female. And on this macro picture that I mentioned at the beginning, it's important to understand that God, as our husband, is the initiator. And we, as his bride, if we choose to become that partially and initially by responding. So he initiates and we respond. And that's what creates our relationship between bride and bridegroom. Okay? A bridegroom gives and the female receives. Now, does this mean we never give? It doesn't. But what this means is that there's a pattern of giving and receiving in order for a relationship to happen. And it's important that we realize that we have to be able to give and we have to be able to receive. But what's the difference between receiving and taking? Because I talked about how Jezebel was a taker, but she wasn't a receiver. So what's the difference? What does a taker do? A taker, well, all we have to do is go back to the garden. God says to Eve, look, I gave you all of this. I initiated by giving you all of this. Just receive this. Dwell in it. But don't touch that. And the enemy comes and he says, you know what? You can take that. Even though he says hands off, you can take that for yourself. And she did. And the enemy convinced her that if she didn't take it, she was missing out on something because God was holding back on her. And that is always what prompts a taker. We're afraid that we're going to miss out on something and that we're going to suffer scarcity. But God says, no, you don't have to ever be motivated by fear and you don't ever have to be a taker because I sit at the gates with the elders of the land and I am in an authority over the authorities and I will offer you and I will give to you and I will supply if you are in a position to receive. And you see what receiving requires that taking doesn't is humility. I've known relationships, marriages that have failed because one partner or the other makes it clear that there is nothing you have to offer me that I need. And there's nothing that the person feels like they can offer the other. How tragic. I know a woman who said, and she's a godly woman, and she said, there was no marriage. She said, he made it clear to me from the very first moment, I had nothing to give him. So he always wanted to make me feel like I was at his mercy, and that's not a healthy relationship. But God sets us up, and he says, there's giving and there's receiving. Yes, I am God, and I give. And if you will receive, then I even put you in a position to give back to me. And what do we give him? We give him our trust. We give him our praise. Give him ourselves. We give him a receiver. Why did God create us in the beginning, in the first place? Because he needed someone to be a receiver, because he is by nature a giver. What good is there being a giver if there's no receiver? So giving and receiving is absolutely essential for relationship. It's interdependent. Remember a moment ago when I was talking about symbiotic, husband-wife. One gives, receives, gives, receives. It's an interdependence. It really is. And this requires humility. If a person isn't capable of expressing gratitude and appreciation, relationships are impossible. That's one of the reasons that when we reject the gift that God gave us, like we were talking last week, of something as basic as his Sabbath, we miss out on a lot of intimacy with him. So I'm going to get very practical here. I want to talk about some of the barriers to being a good receiver. Because we live in a culture that mixes it up a lot. And we're kind of set up as women to be independent and not interdependent. All right? Young women can enroll in College of Women's Studies, and they learn how to avoid the weakness of being a giver and a nurturer in order to make it to the top of the ladder of power and prestige. Isn't that true? These mistaken women often discover loneliness and burnout. And what you're doing is you're becoming more educated and free from the constraints of husbands and children. But the focus becomes more on being a taker and on oneself. And we move on that spectrum to that. We're not a Jezebel, but we're not Valor. And we're trying not to be taken advantage of. We don't want to be taken advantage of. We don't want anyone to take us for granted. We've got to be able to not need anybody. So what are we setting ourselves up for? A loveless life. Because you know what? That kind of life, love is not sustainable. And in the end, love is the key to contentment. And Pam and I rode here together, and she was like, Robin, we were talking about the experience, personal experience recently, where she was, without even realizing it, giving to another person something they needed so much. And in the end, you received the most. How giving you receive. So let's go back to some of the possibilities that kind of sneak into our own lives that can prevent us from being a real receiver and having relationships, whether it's with another human, friend, husband, or with God himself. The first one is shame, or the lie and the belief that you're not worthy to be loved by another. So many women are plagued by shame. And it's a lie. It's one of the enemy's favorites. The next one is fear of not being in control. We're afraid if we lose that control, we're going to be taken advantage of. And so we step back and we... The fear of being taken advantage of. You know, for a moment, let's go back to the passage that I read about God describing the love he has for his bride. What does he do her? He sees her, and when she becomes of an age where she can receive, it's quite the metaphor, hard to understand. We have to stretch to a real macro level. He takes her on instead of a daughter as a lover. And what does he do? He, as her husband now, adorns her. He adorns her. He puts shoes on her feet and robe and jewels. And it goes into great detail about how he... Why does a husband adorn his bride? Because he's a giver, and it puts her in a position to receive his love in the form of an adornment. What if she goes, no. Don't want any of that. You see what I mean? For years, Grant would try to give me gifts, and I'm so practical. And now I know you know what, Grant? It's a beautiful necklace, but we can't afford that. And I would reject his gift. And I thought it was the right thing to do, and he would just be devastated. And it wounded him, and it harmed our relationship, because I was not able to put myself into the position of a receiver, of the way he wanted to express his love to me. You might do that with friendships, but in a marriage, this is critical. Fear of being taken advantage of, a critical and judgmental spirit. Can't be a receiver if you have a critical, judgmental spirit. Here's a big one. Perfectionism. Perfectionism doesn't make space for another. And another barrier is just a lack of trust. And all of the above are rooted in a lack of humility. Because I really believe that the common element in the whole list is ego. And a life dictated by ego is small, and it's fearful, and it's closed. And it can't experience the beauty of a marriage, whether it's with a human or with God himself. Make sense? After all, our master defined true love pretty plainly. He says, greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. But laying down one's life involves giving and receiving, doesn't it? You say, well, how does that? In order for me to lay down my life for someone, I have to have the humility to notice them, to see them. I have to be able to receive and hear and know and take what they have to give me before I can. There's a giving and a receiving. So that field which was purchased by two women that we've looked at, the fool Jezebel, she's the absolute anti-type of humility. She lost everything as a result of her pursuit. But for the woman of valor, the purchase of the field led to riches and honor and contentment. You know, I was thinking a little bit more just yesterday about this whole giving, receiving thing and the whole male and female thing. And this is a big subject. This is a macro subject. It's very practical, and we can start to apply it in little areas of our life. But this is a big subject. I realize that. But God has given us... He's given us a picture of how the male gives and the female receives if she puts herself in a place to receive. And literally, if she receives from the male the seed of potential and allows it to become something that she protects and nurtures in her womb, she gives birth to life. All right? Now, you might say, I'm not talking about a little baby here. I'm talking about any potential. I want us to think about something. God is our husband, and he is the giver. And he places within our lives seeds of potential. So many seeds of potential. One at a time. Let's say one at a time. And because we live in a very broken world, sometimes these seeds of potential that he places in our life and that he entrusts us with, we experience what I'm just going to call a miscarriage. Miscarriages happen not because of something we do wrong, but because things happen. We live in a world that bad stuff happens. It's broken right now, right? And so if a woman has a miscarriage and the seed is lost and that baby doesn't come to full development and birth and a new life isn't here for them to enjoy, is it her fault? No, it happens. It happens to us spiritually. God puts seeds of potential in our life. He puts seeds of potential in our spirit and in our soul. And then because of just the fact that we're broken and we live in a broken world, sometimes things that he gives us that we could have the potential to bring to fruition, it just doesn't come about. And it's not really because of something we've done or haven't done. However, I truly believe that culture always represents physically what's going on in the spiritual realm. And I started thinking about abortion. And I started to think about how many women physically will get rid of a potential life because it doesn't feel like it's good for them. It's not convenient. They can't afford it. Maybe they're afraid. Maybe they just are, you know, whatever reason. But they make a choice to abort a potential life. That seed is lost. We do that spiritually. God places within our life the potential for something. He says, Pam, this is yours. I'm going to give you this. You can bring this to life. You've got it in you to do this. We might be afraid. We might be selfish. We might be whatever, for whatever reason. We get rid of that potential. We get rid of it out of it. We just flush it out and move on. And so we never get to experience what that could have become in our life if we would have received it and nurtured it and allowed it to grow and gave birth to it, which is always painful. Always, always painful. Sometimes I have aborted things that God wanted me to bring to potential in my life because I didn't want to go through the pain. I didn't want to go through the inconvenience. I didn't want to go. Do you see what I mean? So as women, we're in a position to receive, to nurture, to protect, to bring to potential, to give life. It's a big subject. It's even a risky subject to share, but it's really on my heart. I hope you can hear what I'm trying to share with you.
Ron, do you mean something spiritual, yes, or something physical?
Mostly spiritual. Mostly spiritual.
Could you give an example?
Sure. Let's say that there's a guy who teaches industrial arts and he has a special gift for teaching the Bible, and he has a way of just seeing into the word and explaining it so people can get past the initial confusion. And God says, I want you to take this small group and nurture it and feed it and grow it and let it become what I want it to become. And he says, I don't want any part of that. That's not convenient for my life. I'm afraid of that. That's going to cost me money. And so he aborts it. We wouldn't be here. That's an example. Okay?
Can it be a physical thing?
What do you think?
I'm not sure.
What do you ladies think? Can it be a physical thing?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So he gives us a certain amount of money and gives us a home, and he says, I want you to open up this house. You have an extra bedroom. I want you to let girls come there and stay when they have nowhere else to go. I want you to love them. I want you to encourage them. And you say, well, that would be expensive, that would be messy, that would be inconvenient, no, I'm not doing that. And you miss out on all the blessings that you could have had if you would have put yourself aside, got over yourself, and let someone else into your life, received them into your world, and loved on them. You could have had an additional child in your life to grow up and have a relationship with. I've known people who've done that. But we lock ourselves and we make our world small and we cut off potential opportunities because it just looks too complicated. We abort these opportunities. God says, well, all right, I'll give that seed to someone else to carry. They'll do it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's a verse in Psalm 37, it says, but those who wait for the Lord will inherit the land. Yet a little while the wicked man will be no more, and you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. Oh, I can't wait. But the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. There's a poem that was written by the same children's poet that wrote the butterfly poem that I shared with you the first night we met. And here it is. It's called Two Souls. It says, two souls looked out at the world and saw the same thing. One was filled with joy, the other filled with pain. It's not the thing we look upon that paints our point of view, but the heart through which we see it that gives our world its hue. We don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. So if you look out and you see potential possibilities and life and opportunities to nurture and invest yourself and to receive this assignment that God has for you, and you're willing to bring it to life, your world is going to be beautiful. But if you live in fear and you take and you cut yourself off and you just, it shrinks and it's small. And you look out and it's filled with pain. And the person beside you can be looking at the same view and they're filled with joy. The heart through which we see it is what gives our world its hue. That's even confirmed by science, isn't it? I mean, we study quantum physics, and it's been proven that a thing isn't seen without an observer. And it's the observer who makes a thing a thing. Crazy? It's a very spiritual thing. This is a big subject. This is not easy stuff to understand. That's why it's sandwiched in the middle of our text, and it is the climax of what we've been looking at. And our woman of valor, she's doing all the things she does, and she's being who she is, and she's filling her world with life, and she's touching everyone around her, and she's not afraid to take the resources that her husband provides, and she's not trying to find an escape route or an exit strategy because she's nervous about what it might cost her. She's showing up. She's taking the risk. And what was it we were talking about the other day? Kathy Brené Brown describes showing up and taking that risk in life. And do you remember?
Vulnerability.
That word. And without it, you live a very small life. You don't take chances. God forbid you receive something that someone might give you, because then you have a responsibility to do something with it. Mm-mm. I'm going to stay safe. I'm going to stay isolated. I'm going to stay interdependent. I'm going to stay independent. Don't want to be interdependent. That's what women are being told they're supposed to be now. Is it any wonder that people are so miserable and sad and lonely, hopeless? And then we get this weird virus, you guys. Now listen, in our culture, I don't know how serious it really is. I don't get it. But we're in this place where people are being told you need space between you and other people. And I'm like, you know what? It's exactly what's going on spiritually. Everybody's afraid of everyone else. Don't breathe on me. Don't touch me. Don't get too close to me because I might get infected. And I'm like, oh. It's crazy. But the woman of valor, she isn't afraid. She's strong. She's laughing at the future. And she does what she can in the place that she's been placed. And she doesn't have to talk about it all the time. She's just doing it. She's just doing it. So that's our text for tonight. All right? Yeah.